The Way of the Wise Art, Level 2, The Christ Mysteries, being given in Victoria, Australia by John Rawson. Module 9, Resurrection. The Colour, Gold. Welcome back to The Way of the Wise Art. In Module 8, we followed Christ as he took up the path of water. We saw how on this path everything he had achieved as teacher, healer, worker of miracles, and leader was taken away from him. Christ is stripped until, on the cross, he is reduced to the essentials of the human being, a soul and spirit trapped in a pain-filled physical body. The number 8, the path of water, finishes in the tomb. But before the end of number 8, number 9 has already begun, for Christ dies at the 9th hour. Luke's gospel records the event like this. Darkness came over the whole land until the 9th hour, while the light of the sun failed and the curtain of the temple was divided down the middle. Jesus, crying out in a great voice, said, "Father, into your hands I place my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his final breath. We know from level 1 that the number 9 is the number of completion. The 9th hour then represents the completion of the task of Jesus. If you look for a moment at the central image on the image page, you will notice immediately that it is the same image as the central image on the 8th page with one addition. This addition is the image of the sun at the top of the column of spheres. This means that the process of number 9 builds upon the workings of number 8. Let us then return to the end of module 8. Here we left Christ in the tomb. In the outside world, the blood of Christ, infused with the power of the Godhead, has begun its slow work within the earth and the physical world. It will take almost 2,000 years before we begin to see the fruits of this work. But meanwhile, inside the tomb, there is another change happening. Perceive with the eye of the mind the darkness of that small rough-cut cave in the rock that now comprises the tomb of Jesus. The body has been wrapped in cloths by the women who accompanied Jesus to the cross. As the early hours of the morning pass us by, the form of the body beneath the cloths seems to lose its shape. Water is pooling through the bands of linen and soaking into the floor. We have been given a clue by the actions of the soldier at the cross who thrust a spear into the side of Jesus. If you remember from Module 8, both blood and water came out. The transformation was already beginning on the cross. The physical body of Jesus is being transformed into water. It is being transformed into something else too. It is being transformed into light. This is, in fact, the third initiation. The initiation of light. In the final step of the water path, even the physical body is dissolved. In this dissolution, something is released, and that is what we might call the inner reality of the physical body. This reality is a spiritual energy. St. Paul calls it the resurrection body. This energy has contained within itself all the physical energies and atoms of the physical body. Now these energies and atoms are being released back into the matrix of Mother Earth from whence they came. But the real physical body remains. If we were only watching with our physical eyes, then we would see nothing. It is only with the eyes of spirit that we can perceive the spiritual body of Jesus, perhaps as a rainbow of light. Then, in its turn, this light also disappears. It will not return to the tomb, for the tomb, acting as the womb for this new birth, has completed its work. Where does Christ go? The answer is given in an enigmatic passage in the first letter of St. Peter. For Christ also suffered once on behalf of sins, the just for the unjust, so that he should bring us to God, becoming dead in the body, but living in the spirit, in which he also journeyed and preached to the spirits in prison. These spirits in a former time disobeyed when the forbearance of God waited expectantly in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, 8 souls, were saved through water. According to Peter, when Christ became dead in the body, he became living in the spirit and then went on a journey. This journey took him to the spirits in prison. Who were these spirits in prison? Peter seems to think that his next phrase will clear matters up. These spirits, in a former time, disobeyed in the days of Noah. Now, that phrase, the days of Noah, refers to the period occultists have come to name Atlantis. The Atlantean period was a critical time in our evolution, for it was during this age that an aspect of the individuality was first given to humanity. There have been some very interesting descriptions of the fabled Atlantis, which describe it as a technological utopia holding the secrets of wisdom and world peace. In actual fact, our objective knowledge of Atlantis derives from its appearance in 2 dialogues of Plato, the Timaeus and the Critias. Plato describes the Atlanteans as having great power, but morally bankrupt. Attempting world domination, the only thing stopping them is a small group of spiritually pure, incorruptible people. Plato tells us that Atlantis is destroyed by earthquakes and floods, where the whole of the land sinks almost overnight, and only a few escape. When we look back with spiritual vision, we discover that the whole of the human race once passed through an episode that we might call Atlantis. This episode stretches over a time of more than 100,000 years, a much greater period of time than the whole of recorded history. In the early stages of this period, human beings lived very close to spirit. They didn't need to build cities or impressive monuments, for nature gave them everything they needed. Gradually, there was a movement away from spirit and a differentiation into groups. Each group was oriented around an institution we might loosely call a temple. The temples contained the energies of one of the planetary spheres. So there was a Venus temple, a Mars temple, a Moon temple, and so on. At the beginning of the Atlantean era, and then more recently, about 20,000 years ago, Christ manifested within the Atlantean culture, not in a human body, of course, but as an etheric form. The Atlanteans perceived Christ not as a human being, but as a huge fish. Something of this memory is preserved in the story of Jonah and the whale, which is a dim recollection of the initiation into the Christ mysteries in the time of Atlantis. If you are familiar with some of the gospel narratives, you will recognize the signature of Christ in Atlantis in the stories of feeding the multitudes with a few loaves of bread and some fish. The disciples, of course, were fishermen, which signified they had been part of the Christ mysteries in the Atlantean epoch. At the very end of the Gospel of St. John, Christ has the disciples catch a huge quantity of fish to signify that the task of the Atlantean period has now been completed. For a similar reason, early Christians adopted the symbol of the fish. What was the task of Christ in the Atlantean period? The work of the Christ impulse was to implant a seed of the individuality within the soul. The form that this seed took was the gift of speech. This was a sort of telepathy where we intuitively understood the thoughts and emotions of others at this particular time. We were, in fact, before Christ gave us the gift of speech, connected mentally. You can sometimes see this sort of telepathic communication watching animals communicate. Lionesses hunting a prey, for example, communicate their strategies directly through the astral. They can do this because they share an astral. In the early days of Atlantis, human beings shared an astral because at this stage we were connected to a group soul. When the Christ impulse was first given in early Atlantis, we lost the connection with a group soul and had to begin building an individual soul. We also lost the astral connection, and so we were forced into finding a method of communication through sound. The book of Genesis says of those early days, "The whole earth had one language and few words." The destruction of the Tower of Babel is a metaphor for the loss of the original telepathic communication and the development of speech. You can understand how there is little incentive to develop a sense of the individual within a shared consciousness. There is only a we, not an I. The group consciousness actually remains within many people even today, which is why human beings like to identify themselves with a group, whether this is a family, a tribe, or a nation, or even a football team. The role of Christ in the creation of speech is put in front of us in the very opening phrase of the Gospel of St. John. "In a beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was divine." Just note for a moment that the word is divine. That is, your word, my word, has the power of divinity within it. Our word contains power. This power is double-edged. A charismatic dictator can sway a nation to commit atrocious acts of violence through the word. The power of the word can be used to create a hell on earth, and this is the misuse of the word. When used with integrity, the word can uplift and inspire. It can create works of impossible beauty. It can create a life of courage. It can create a heaven on earth. As individuals, we need to be meticulous in the way we use our speech. Even today, what we say will create our lives. A person who is consistently negative in their speech, always finding flaws with their life, with their career, with their family, with other people, will find they become encaged in a prison of their own making. But someone who always strives to speak in the positive of their own life and of those they encounter, that person will create freedom. Let us return to Atlantis. Quite early in the Atlantean period, humanity was given the gift of the word. Over what seems to us a very long period of time, but in the eyes of the gods is very brief, the Atlanteans learned the power of the word. The world of Atlantis is so far distant from our modern world that it is difficult for our consciousness to perceive it with clarity and objectivity. The Atlanteans did not have our technology, but they had other abilities. For example, in those days, a person could plant a seed and say, "Grow." The seed would immediately begin to grow, and in a very short time, it could become a full-grown plant. On the other hand, if you wanted to harm an enemy, you didn't need to throw a spear or shoot an arrow. A well-aimed insult delivered to catch the person's unawares would immediately create an injury that could be fatal. The Atlantean energies worked within the etheric levels. In this way, growth and healing could be facilitated, but also so could harm and injury. There are traces of this in certain cultures even today. The Aboriginal peoples of Australia have a ceremony called pointing the bone. There are many recorded occasions when the victim of the ceremony loses the will to live and simply withers away. Interestingly, in 2004, Indigenous Australians who disagreed with the policies of John Howard, the then Prime Minister, ritually cursed him by pointing a bone at him. In 2015, John Howard is still very much alive, which may indicate that a politician may live so much in the astral levels that their etheric is too repressed to be affected. The gift of speech was given to empower the development of a sense of I in humanity. Unfortunately, those who took this completely on board were few in number. Most of humanity found a way to abdicate from this path. They did this by allowing other forces to take possession of their consciousness. In other words, rather than seeking freedom, they became slaves. St. Paul, with his usual cogency, puts it this way. When we were children, we were slaves to the elemental spirits of the universe. These elemental spirits were the forces of Ahriman and Lucifer. Over a period of thousands of years, the negative forces corrupted the temples. There was one exception to this. The Temple of the Sun maintained its purity. Those who were kings and queens in Atlantis were all from the Temple of the Sun. The Hermetica retains a memory of this when it refers to kingly souls. These were the souls of those who originated within the sphere of the sun and belonged to the Sun Temple in Atlantis. The nature of the beings of the Sun Temple was also the nature of a priest. So the Atlantean ruler was both king and priest. There is a memory of this in the name Melchizedek, who is described in the book of Genesis as both king of Salem and priest of God Most High. In Module 8, we talked about the fire path, which is the path of power, and the water path, the path of surrender. In Atlantis, a conflict arose between those who chose the path of fire and those who had chosen the path of water. Those on the fire path were those who had become slaves to spiritual powers for the purpose of acquiring and increasing their own power. Sometimes in spiritual readings, we see that souls who made this choice in Atlantis may now desperately seek psychic power again, but this can never happen. An enormous conflict eventually arose. Those who had become instruments of the negative forces are known as the Grey Ones. They were called this because they were so controlled by another power that their own personality and self became muted and dulled. The overpowering negativity infused their auras with shades of grey. The leaders of the Grey Ones raised enormous forces from nature in their attempt to conquer the continent. Volcanic eruptions and earthquakes were just some of the results of this. The consciousness of their followers was reduced to a sort of permanent hypnotic trance. Free will was lost. Those, on the other hand, who hadn't given up their consciousness, but who had chosen individuality, those who were captured were subjected to terrible torture, which affected them for many incarnations. Now, many of these souls who voluntarily gave up their individual consciousness in Atlantis, when they incarnate now, are still in a sort of trance. They seek power in life over others. This may be through the pursuit of money, career, business, or through religion. The current development of what has been called Islamic fundamentalism is a reflection of the Atlantean struggles. The basis of participation in such movements as Islamic State, IS, has nothing to do with the religion of Islam. It has everything to do with people throwing away their own individual consciousness and allowing themselves to be indoctrinated with negativity in such a way that personal values and experience becomes enslaved to an overriding doctrine imposed by an outside authority. From here, it becomes a simple step to carrying out acts that normal consciousness would consider abhorrent. Such souls have fallen asleep, as St. Paul put it. If you direct your attention for a moment to the picture in the bottom left-hand corner of the image page, you will see a sort of reflection of this consciousness through the lens of alchemy. Here, the king dressed in red represents the ruler completely overcome with the need for power. He is directing his followers to remove the newly given impulse of individuality by taking the newborns and subjecting them to a process which will remove their ability to speak and think independently. The women lying on the ground in despair are the souls who have been deprived of the gift of the Christ impulse. In Atlantis, as we saw, the Sun Temple alone remained untouched by the negative forces. Only in the Sun Temple was the path of water embraced. One of the acts undertaken by some of the initiates of the temple was to allow their spiritual perception to become sealed off. No longer would they have the advantages of clairvoyant perception or be able to contact the higher spiritual worlds for guidance and advice. The surrender of these old abilities allowed for the development of new abilities in the course of later incarnations, but this would be some thousands of years in the future. We see the first flowering of these abilities in the development of the thinking of the Greek and Indian philosophers. Finally, the forces of the Grey Ones conquered. The last act of the Guardians of Atlantis was to call upon the power of water. In an event of cataclysmic proportions, the sea arose and drowned the land, which, broken apart by the violence of earthquakes and volcanoes, sunk beneath the waves. The last sun initiate is named as Noah in Genesis. If we remember that the number 8 is about the water path, then we understand that the 8 souls who sailed on the ark with Noah tell us firstly that from the Sun Temple, those who had become initiates on the water path survived. But also, since 8 is the foundation of the name Jesus, the purpose of those who fled from Atlantis at that time was to take something of the essence of the Sun Temple to begin the new work, the preparation of the body of Jesus, so that the next incarnation of Christ would be into a physical body. In the modules of level 2, we have followed the incarnation of Christ into the physical body of a man called Jesus. We have trod behind him on his path. First, the fire path of achievement, and then finally the water path of surrender. It is only now the two paths are complete that Christ is released from the world of physical existence. In this time between the death on the cross and the resurrection appearances, Christ goes in search of the lost souls. These were the souls who, in Atlantis, renounced their individuality. If they did so in order to gain power, then by the inexorable law of cause and effect, they become slaves. For many centuries, it became more and more for these souls to gain entry to the spiritual worlds after death. They became earthbound. If we study the stories of the afterlife in ancient religions, then we cannot help but be struck by their pessimistic outlook. When Plato relates the last hours of Socrates in the dialogue Phaedo, he has Socrates tell us the soul makes its way to Hades, which is a realm of the underworld. There it exists as a shade, an impotent shadow, until it can come back into incarnation. Only the very few who have practiced philosophy and are completely pure in departing from life can join the gods, that is, enter the higher spiritual worlds. At the time of Christ's incarnation, then, The souls who in Atlantis had refused the gift of individuality were, as St. Peter puts it, in prison. It is these souls whom Christ visits. In the early days of Christianity, this act was called the harrowing of hell. I am indebted to John Plummer for this wonderful passage from the Odes of Solomon, an early Christian writing, where Christ, having descended into the underworld, says, "I have opened the closed doors. I have shattered the bars of iron. My own shackles melted away. Nothing is closed any longer, for I am the door of all things. I freed the slaves, leaving no one in bondage any longer." There is another way to understand what Christ was doing in this time. He was releasing us from the bonds of karma. A teacher was once asked by his pupil to explain the workings of the human consciousness. The teacher took a glass and poured some clear water into it. "This," he said, "is the original nature of the human being." The teacher then took some red earth and sprinkled it into the glass. He stirred it around until the whole glass was filled with the red particles. The earth represents all the negative influences we have taken on in our incarnations. It represents the negative thought patterns and the old karma which we have accumulated over many lives. "The constant stirring up of these energies," the teacher said, "disorient us and confuse us." The confusion is seen within our auras. Until a person decides to step onto the spiritual path, the aura is normally quite cloudy and dull. As we commit ourselves more and more to ourselves as spiritual beings, the aura becomes clearer and the colours vibrant and pure. The glass of water is settling and becoming clear. Spiritual practice, however, will continually stir up the old negativities. This manifests within the life as sudden, often explosive conflict. This conflict results from past karma being brought into focus so that we might resolve it once and for all. Forgiveness of sins is a fundamental principle of the message of the Church. How are we to understand this in terms of our karma? There is a famous passage from the letter to the Ephesians where Paul says, "In him we have the setting free because of his blood, the cancellation of our misdeeds according to the riches of his grace." The word I have translated as misdeeds has the meaning of a false step, a slip, or a blunder, perhaps a slip-up. It is connected with another word which means to fasten beside. It seems to me that Paul has perfectly represented here the process of karma. Like a misstep, karma was originally unconscious, for few of us make a conscious choice to slip up. What is it that fastens our karma to us? It is our guilt. Even in a single life, we may accrue huge amounts of guilt. We may feel guilty about the way we treated our parents, and then later on, how we treat our children. We can feel guilty about our relationships, our accomplishments, what we do, what we don't do. Life supplies an endless supply of things to feel guilty about. What Christ has done for us is to remove the guilt which ties us to our karma. When Paul says that the blood of Christ has set us free, then the power in the blood of Christ, which streamed into the earth at Golgotha, has cut the ties between our karma and our guilt, because it has made us conscious. Notice I'm not saying that Christ has cancelled or removed our karma. This is still ours to deal with, but now we can deal with it in consciousness without the crushing burden of the associated guilt. When Christ released the imprisoned souls from the levels of the spiritual underworld, he also released us from the guilt which tied us to our karma. Now we are able to say in full consciousness, I shall repay what I owe. Just to make this statement is in itself incredibly freeing. Christ has freed us in another way too. Often life presents us with difficult, painful, even cruel dilemmas. Life does not present us with the solutions or course of actions for these challenges. That is up to us to come up with. How do we know how to pick the right course of action? Well, we could, of course, consult a psychic. That would take us right back to the consciousness of Atlantis. Now we are expected to make decisions from our own consciousness. Inside each of us is a knowledge of the right. From this intuitive knowledge, we arrive at a course of action. Through the power of the Christ impulse, we can now say, I have made a decision based, as far as I know, on what is right for me and others. I am willing to take the consequences of such a decision. If we can say this in pure consciousness, then karma does not become attached to us from our actions. I would like to give an example to clarify this concept. A woman and a man were drawn together for reasons of karma. The man had left the woman in a previous life, where she died of hunger and thirst because she did not have the skills to provide for herself. In their current incarnation, the woman trained herself and acquired university qualifications. She was well able to support herself. She now encountered the man who had been her husband in the previous life. They were attracted together and formed a relationship. In this relationship, she was the dominant partner and began making greater and greater demands of the other person. The more demands she made and the more support she expected and received, the less she was able to do for herself. The partner, because of the previous karma and the guilt associated with that, now felt obligated, out of his guilt, to support the woman, which he did for many years. One day, however, he realized that his support was of no benefit to the woman because she was becoming weaker and weaker. This is the point at which he allowed himself to be freed from his guilt. And having been freed from his guilt, he made the decision to break away from the relationship. This time, instead of leaving her deserted, he made sure that she would be looked after financially. In this instance, there are three aspects of the decision. In the first place, he had repaid the debt from the previous life. Secondly, he knew that the relationship had turned toxic and was preventing him from leading a responsible and creative life. And lastly, he observed that his support had become a negative force because it was depriving the other person from using their own abilities and strengths. In this example, because the decision was thought through with honesty and integrity, no further karmic debt ensued, although the decision certainly created some long-term pain and discomfort for both parties. Once again, the work of Christ is always about consciousness. If we persist in denying the gift of consciousness and continually deny the realities which are put before us in the course of life, then we shall continue to create karma. Christ is in the tomb for 3 days. In this time, the Christ impulse works to free us from the actions of the past. Let us pick up the story from the 3rd day. Mary Magdalene came while it was still dark, early in the morning, to the tomb, and she saw the stone rolled away from the tomb. John's Gospel tells us that Mary Magdalene went and called Peter and John, the disciple whom Jesus loved, and they found the tomb empty. Having made sure of this, they returned to their homes, but Mary remained in the garden. We pick up the story again. Mary stood outside the tomb, weeping. As she was weeping, she stooped to look into the tomb, and she saw 2 angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. We can tell that Mary is very clairvoyant, for she and not either of the disciples perceived the angels. It is important to realize this in order to understand what follows next. Mary turned and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for?" She, thinking that he was the gardener, said to him, "Lord, if you took him away, tell me where you put him, and I will go and take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." Turning round, she said in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not touch me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I am rising to my Father and your Father, and my God and your God." When I first became part of Reverend Mario Schoonmaker's centre, he sent me along to the Uniting Church Theological Seminary to learn Greek. One of my Greek tutors was a Jesuit priest, a very learned man. He read this part of St. John's Gospel out to us and said meditatively, "You realize, of course, that this body of the resurrection is not an ordinary physical body. In the first place, Mary, who had been with Jesus for the whole ministry, didn't recognize him at first, and in the second place, she couldn't touch him. The idea that Jesus was not resurrected in a physical body was a hard concept for my fellow students who were all studying for the ministry of the Uniting Church to grasp. Nevertheless, St. John makes it plain that what Mary perceives is not what we would call a physical body. It is only Mary's clairvoyance that allows her to be the first of the disciples to perceive the risen Christ in his resurrection body. Christ has returned from his journeys in the underworld. The journey of Christ is symbolized by the tarot card in the bottom right-hand corner of the page, the Hermit. In this card, we can see the carrying of the light in the darkness. The Hermit is the last card of the first 9 numbers of the Major Arcana. So it represents the completion of the work of Christ begun in the distant past. The phase of the Christ event is concerned with the past, correcting the mistakes made by humanity in our past and giving us a new light, the light of the individuality, to guide us. Now the work of Christ will be to set a pattern for the future. The meeting with Mary Magdalene signifies that in the future, humanity will be able to perceive the risen Christ through clairvoyant perception. This is a clairvoyance that is developed not through techniques and exercises, but through love. Christ is very definite that he has to go somewhere else. He has to ascend to the Father. The Father is represented by the highest Sephira on the Tree of Life, Kether. The sphere of Christ is the sphere of Tifereth. Christ begins the journey back to the Father from the lowest Sephira, Malkuth, the realm of earthly consciousness. On this journey, Christ will transform every aspect of his humanity into an aspect of the divine. The journey to the divine is represented in the Indian tradition by the diagram in the top right-hand corner. This shows a series of 9 triangles inscribed within a circle. Here the journey becomes a journey into the center of our being. In the West, we represent this as a journey on a vertical axis. The 9 is the second square number. The Greeks coined the term square number because they represented numbers by pebbles laid out in rows and patterns. In the first 10 numbers, only 4 and 9 make squares. The square pattern of 9 is depicted in the top left-hand corner of the image page. The 3 rows of 3 show that the ascent to the Father is through 3 groups of aspects of humanity. We begin with the first stage of the ascent. This is the earth sphere, depicted at the bottom of the column of spheres central to the image page. The earth sphere represents the physical body. Christ has transformed this body. He then rises to the next sphere, the red, which represents the etheric levels, and then to the astral sphere, orange on the diagram. This is the bottom row of the 3 rows of 9, of the image from the top left-hand corner of the page. Each of these 3 aspects of the human being becomes transformed into an element of the soul. In this transformation, we experience the middle row of the square of 9. This is the evolution of the real I. The astral is transformed into the sentient soul, the etheric into the intellectual soul, and the physical into the consciousness soul. We have now reached the third level on the square of 9, the indigo sphere on the central column. For each aspect of the soul is now transformed into spirit. The astral becomes the spirit self. At this stage, the faculty of intuition or direct knowledge becomes available to humanity. The etheric is transformed into life spirit. At this stage, we shall have continuity of consciousness between this life and life in spirit. We shall again have direct communion with the spiritual worlds. Finally, this physical body is transformed completely into the spirit man. At this stage, we shall again be able to reside in the spiritual worlds. The union with the divinity within us is symbolized in the central diagram as a sun. For now we have achieved total consciousness in every aspect of our being. Christ has now ascended to the Father. He has completely spiritualized his physical body. Only now will he be able to return to the disciples in a body which can be perceived and touched and held. This journey of Christ has completed our human journey. After Christ has ascended to the Father, he is able to bestow a precious gift first upon his disciples and then upon humanity. This is the gift of the fullness of individuality. This gift means that we can all aspire to follow Christ in future incarnations. We can return to the spiritual worlds from which we departed so many aeons ago. When we return, however, we shall not be the same beings as those who began the journey. Rather, we shall be changed, transformed. As Jesus said to the scribes, we shall be like angels. Finally, let us refer to our verse which summarizes our whole experience of Module 9. Is there a crown above the head? Do the clouds hide the sun instead? Though man may stoop below the beast, spirit still ferments as yeast. The wizards to the soul may bring the vision of the sun-crowned king. We have seen Christ rising to claim for us the crown above the head, the eventual union with the divine. That part of us is always with us. It is only the clouds of the astral which obscure our connection with the Godhead. We have experienced man stooping below the beast, but we have also experienced how the power of Christ, given through the Christ event, has implanted another seed within us. And who are the wizards who must bring the vision of the sun-crowned king to the human soul? Of course, it is you and I. And all those souls who are admitted through the portals of the mystery of Christ. We knock at the door of the temple, but then, as the Odes of Solomon put it, Christ is the door. It is not only you and I that knock. Christ is knocking at the door of our temple, our consciousness. As the book of Revelation puts it, we need to hear this knocking, open the door, and invite him into our consciousness. It is from this point on that we become filled with a new consciousness of the Christ, which will work on us day after day and night after night, until in the finality, changed utterly from what we were, we return to whence we came, the union with the divine. I look forward to being with you in Module 10. So shall it be.